for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For years, women over 40 have been told they should be getting a mammogram every year to screen for breast cancer. But now an independent government-funded task force has concluded that for women under 50 with no special risk factors, risks may outweigh benefits. Joining me to talk about the new guidelines, Dr. Rebecca Zerbier. She's Director of Breast Imaging at the Sullivan Center for Breast Health at Sibley Memorial Hospital here in Washington. And joining us from a studio at KJAZZ in Phoenix, Arizona, Dr. Diana Petiti. She's Vice Chair of the U.S. Prevention Services Task Force. She's also Professor of Biomedical Informatics at Arizona State University. I know this is an issue that has created a great deal of controversy and left women with many questions, which we hope we can answer this morning. Do join us with your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, Dr. Zerbier. It's good to have you here.
Good morning. Thank you.
And to you, Dr. Petiti, good morning to you.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Tell us about these new guidelines, Dr. Petiti, and give us a brief summary, if you would, of the recommendations.
Well, first of all, I want to be very clear that the recommendations are not against women being screened in their 40s. The recommendations are specifically against women being routinely screened. That means getting a, for example, postcard in the mail saying you need to come in and have a mammogram. The task force feels that the decision about an age to start being screened at some time between 40 and 50 is one that should be based on an individualized discussion of a woman with her physician about the trade-offs of benefits and harms. Again, this is not a recommendation against ever screening women in their 40s. It's not a recommendation to wait to your 50s. It's a recommendation in favor of discussion of a woman with her physician about when to start being screened.
Just before you go on, talk about the benefits versus the harms that you just mentioned.
Well, all of the screen, there is no one-to-one match between having a mammogram and finding cancer. Indeed, it's a probability, and that probability of finding a cancer goes up sharply with age. So the benefit is finding a cancer that can be treated and managed early. The harms, or the negatives, are having a test that is positive and having that test turn out to be falsely positive. The harm is in the anxiety from the time of that positive test to finding out with certainty that there is no cancer. Again, it's a risk and harm or risk and negative trade-off for women at every age.
I gather the report is also recommending biennial screening mammography for women age 50 to 74.
Yes. The previous recommendation of the task force issued in 2002 was for screening every 1 to 2 years. The current recommendation, based on a review of the evidence showing what the trade-offs might be between benefits and harms, is for explicitly screening every other year rather than every sort of 1 to 2 years, which was quite a vague recommendation. And by the way, the recommendation about screening interval applies not only to women in their 50s, but women in their 40s who might choose, based on this discussion with their physician, to have screening.
So, once again, the harms would be the anxieties, the false positives, and you feel that that may outweigh, or the group has felt that that may outweigh routine mammography during those years?
Again, it's about having a discussion so that there's a clear understanding of what those trade-offs are and how large the benefit might be for a woman in her 40s compared with a woman in her 50s, and how large the harms might be or how common these harms or negatives might be. Again, it's about a trade-off between starting in your 40s or starting in your 50s, and it's a choice that a woman should make on her own, speaking with her physician.
Can you describe the types of data you were looking at to analyze the benefits and the risks of breast cancer screening?
Well, there are three specific lines of evidence that led to this set of recommendations. The first one was information published in 2006 from a trial that was done in the United Kingdom of starting screening women in their 40s. And this information, in the context of other studies, similar studies of starting screening in the 40s, allowed a very precise estimation of the amount of benefit from screening starting in the 40s compared with starting in later years, say the 50s. The second line of evidence was information from a large National Cancer Institute-sponsored study that allowed a more precise quantification of just how frequent these false positives are and how many imaging tests there are and how many women need to be screened in order to find one breast cancer. The third line of evidence was from a modeling study that was done by the National Cancer Institute investigators that, again, allowed these trade-offs to be more precisely quantified. This was, by the way, not anything about a cost-effectiveness analysis.
Also, let me ask you about the recommendation that doctors no longer instruct women to do self-examinations, no longer spend the time to teach them to do that. Why is that part of this report?
Since in 2002, the task force felt that there was insufficient evidence to make any statement one way or another about teaching women about breast self-examination. Since 2002, two very large randomized clinical trial results have been published, and both of these studies, one done in China, one done in Russia, involving almost 500,000 women, showed that, in fact, teaching women breast self-examination did not translate to a reduction in death due to breast cancer.
And
so in the absence of benefit of teaching women breast self-examination, the task force felt that this was not something that was worth the time of the physician or would benefit women in terms of their breast health.
But what about the women who say that that's how they discovered that they had a lump in the breast?
Well, I think the task force doesn't want women to ignore lumps in their breast, nor does it in any way discount that this is the way that many women find their breast cancer. The fact is, though, that the evidence from these trials does not show an overall benefit of teaching women about breast self-examination.
Dr. Diana Petiti, she is vice chair of the U.S. Prevention Services Task Force. She's also professor of biomedical informatics at Arizona State University. Turning to you now, Dr. Zerbier, is the issue that regular mammograms, from your perspectives, saves lives?
This isn't just from my perspective. This is, in fact, from the task force perspective. They admit that there is a decrease in the number of deaths from breast cancer in their own study, on the order of the same magnitude as other groups such as women in their 50s. They happen to cite the lowest possible number that they could find, which is 15%, when in the United States, Sweden, the Netherlands, for example, there are documented mortality reductions as high as 40% and over 40% in certain areas of Sweden. So let no one come away from this hearing the task force saying that it doesn't benefit women in their 40s. When we look at the argument, in fact, that they say, well, the harms outweigh the benefits. We know there are benefits, but there are harms. I would only say that women have accepted these harms. The women in their 40s account for 25% of breast cancers. This is not an inconsiderable number. Also consider that women in their 40s who get breast cancer account for the most number of years of life lost. This is a population that effectively, because of this study, and I can hear them trying to backtrack and saying, well, we're not against routine screening, and we'll get to that in a minute. But this is a group of people who have said, we'll take the risk. Currently, they have the option of discussing it with their doctor. They have the option of not undergoing a mammogram. And with these so-called guidelines from a non-peer-reviewed set of studies not critically discussed, except here in your studio now after the bomb has exploded, we're coming to have to deal with the effective impact of women hearing that they don't need to be screened. And an insurance company, in fact, in New York, I heard an HMO said, you bet we're going to be listening to this. You know, we're going to base our coverage based on this. So this study will take away the option that women currently have to be screened with a life-saving study, and we're leaving them with nothing. No breast exam, no self-breast exam, no breast examination by their physician. And so I think it's pathetic and disingenuous to say that we're not against screening mammography when the actual effect is to take away this study from these women.
Dr. Rebecca Zerbier, she's director of breast imaging at Sibley Memorial Hospital here in Washington, D.C. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk further about, clearly, a controversial study. And we're discussing the new guidelines issued by the U.S. Prevention Services Task Force. With me on the line from Arizona State University, with the help of KJAZ, our affiliate out there in Arizona, Dr. Diana Petiti. She's vice chair of that task force. Here in the studio, Dr. Rebecca Zerbier, director of breast imaging at Sibley Memorial Hospital here in Washington, D.C. Here's our first email. It's from Heather, who says, I am 54. I know many, many women with breast cancer, some who did not make it, most of whom found their cancers themselves before getting confirmation by mammogram. Why on earth would any responsible doctor recommend we not do self-exams? Dr. Petiti.
Again, I want to make clear that this recommendation is about the time that physicians would spend teaching women to do self-examination and about the evidence. The data from these studies is very clear that teaching women breast self-examination does not prevent mortality due to breast cancer on a population basis.
Dr. Zerbier, do you want to comment?
Absolutely. To tell women to disregard their breasts, which is effectively, again, they may say this isn't what we're saying, but it's the message that's coming out, is a great disservice. Women do find lumps, and that's what generates their trip to a physician to have the mammogram. So you cannot tell women to ignore their breasts, and that's the message that's coming out. Again, intended or not, patients, when they dialogue with their physicians, are not having a Diane Rehm NPR-level discourse. They're asking, what should I do? And I think this task force is trying to step back. Routine screening is basically redundant. A screening examination is meant to catch cancers where you don't expect to find it or where there's not a high risk. And so just screening women who are at high risk is going to miss 75 to 90% of breast cancers. 75% of cancers occur in women with no other risk factors.
Dr. Zerbier, you said that 25% of breast cancers occur in women in their 40s. What percentage of those found to have cancer during those ages actually die from it?
I don't have that actual number. We do know that the cancers in women in their 40s tend to be more lethal and more aggressive. So we don't stand here saying that it's the perfect test. But frankly, it's the only test we have. And this panel is saying we're withdrawing our support for this test and for breast self-exam and clinical breast examination.
I really think it's important that we all try to make a consistent message. And the task force is not backing down from saying from its recommendation. The task force was very clear that this is not a recommendation against screening women in their 40s. It's a recommendation against routine screening, where routine screening is one that doesn't take place with the dialogue with the physician. The postcard comes in the mail and says this is something you should do. That may not be the way that medicine is practiced in everywhere. But again, the task force should not be faulted for bringing forward evidence that allows better decision making and a better dialogue between women and their physicians.
What about that, Dr. Zerbier? She's saying is the conversation needs to take place with the physician rather than simply responding to the postcard, which comes yearly, mm-hmm. and says, it's 1 year, you are due for a mammogram.
Right. Well, first of all, not everybody sends out postcards. Secondly, I'm like Sanjay Gupta on CNN this morning saying, what am I supposed to tell them? You know, what are we supposed to say? We're supposed to say the task force just said we have to talk with you, but what are we supposed to say? The fact is mammograms save lives for women in their 40s, and this is not to be disregarded. And the message coming from this task force is very dangerous for women, and women's lives will be lost to breast cancer because women are saying, I guess I shouldn't show up. So women aren't even going to be calling their doctor to have these dialogues are supposed to occur. Women have been able to access screening without having to stop to see the physician. And so you're creating inefficiencies in the system that way. You haven't even gone on to consider the impact of delayed diagnosis of breast cancer in terms of the additional morbidity, the more aggressive treatments. If we want to move on from women in their 40s, where again you say it's beneficial, to going to biennial in women in their 50s, we even know that we're going to lose lives there. This is purely cost-cutting, and it shouldn't be mistaken for anything but.
Let me understand, Dr. Petiti, who are the members of the task force?
The task force has 16 members. The members are experts in primary care and prevention. The members are appointed with the approval of the head of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. The process involves nomination, public nomination of potential members, and then a vetting process of trying to select those people who are prominent in their field and who are evidence-based.
Can you give me a sense of how many are physicians dealing with breast cancer? How many are perhaps more on the financial side? How many are epidemiologists? Can you give me that range?
I haven't done that tally. The primary care physicians are the prominent group of physicians who are represented. There are three, I think, family practitioners, two OBGYN physicians, two pediatricians, three or four epidemiologists. There is one, two behavioral scientists. I'm sorry that I'm not prepared to give the exact breakdown
what about,
of the qualifications.
What about insurance company representatives? Are there insurance company representatives on the task force?
No, there are not.
None.
George Isham is the medical director of Health Partners. I guess someone might try to portray him as an insurance company executive.
So what about Dr. Zerbier's contention that, in fact, this may be more about money than prevention?
I can say with complete certainty and promise that cost was not discussed in making these recommendations. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has many groups that would like for us to do cost-effectiveness analysis and to consider cost, but that is not our role. Our role is to describe the evidence and present information that allows women to make an informed decision about whether and what age to begin being screened.
Are you at all concerned that with these recommendations from this task force that insurance companies may then say, well, with these recommendations, we are no longer going to pay for routine screening between the ages of 40 and 50.
I can say that I'm personally, and I think the members of the task force, are quite concerned about the way that these recommendations are being misinterpreted and misrepresented. And certainly if the consequence were to deny women of any age a mammogram that they decided that they wanted after weighing the risks and benefits, it would be a negative. Again, it would be an unintended consequence.
All right. Dr. Zerbier, what about the risks of over-treatment, unnecessary biopsies,
sure,
extra films, the mammograms themselves?
Right, right. No, great question. I think what we've heard is, the very disquieting admission that there was an insurance person on the board and that there were no breast cancer experts on the boards. So that does not put them in a position to carefully examine the quality and efficacy of these different diagnostic tests that are available. Mammography, specifically digital mammography, has been shown to be more effective than film screen mammography in three groups of people: premenopausal women, women less than 50, and women with dense breasts. They did not take into account that this is in more widespread use and probably result in fewer deaths. No breast cancer has been caused by a mammogram. In fact, we've seen a decline in the number of deaths from breast cancer from all age groups screened. In fact, there was a very compelling abstract presented that showed that when people die from breast cancer, 75% of them were in the group that were not screened. 25% were in the group that were screened. It's important also to note that there's no other test. When this study came out, I thought, well, gee, maybe this task force knows something better on the horizon than I knew about. And in fact, there's nothing better out there.
Dr. Petiti, can you suggest to us the reasoning behind not having a breast cancer specialist on this task force?
I think I've described the task force is a standing committee. It addresses a large number of topics in its portfolio of topics. The people on the task force regularly look at evidence about screening and do systematic reviews. I'm sort of trying to also get back to maybe having the other physician on this call answer your question about the frequency of false positives.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But I really do want to understand why there was no breast cancer specialist on this task force.
Again, it's a standing committee whose composition...
I understand it's a standing committee, but you're dealing with breast cancer. And therefore, to exclude a breast cancer specialist on that task force would raise certainly questions in a great many people's minds, I would think.
I don't even begin to know how to respond except to explain that this is a group that has wide expertise on prevention and the uses of evidence to make prevention-related recommendations.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Zerbier, what about the false positives and the biopsies?
I think there's room for improvement. Mammography is one of the most regulated areas. We have to look at our callback ratios, how often when we recommend a biopsy, is it actually shown to be cancer versus non-cancer. And so we're actually at the safest, most effective, and efficient level. With the use of core biopsy, you don't go to surgery unnecessarily. And in fact, at Sibley, we're looking at surgery positive predictive values. We're taking it one step further in order to avoid false positives and anxiety. And frankly, women have said, I'll accept the anxiety. They have the choice to avoid the test completely currently. That option is being taken away from them effectively. And the tests that are required are minimally invasive in most cases. And women themselves have said, I accept this risk. I need to live. I'm taking care of children. I'm taking care of parents. I'm working in the home. I'm working out of the home. So losing a 40-year-old person or 40 to 49-year-old person's life to breast cancer would be a travesty.
And we're joined now by Nancy Dubler. She's senior associate at Montefiore Einstein Bioethics Center. She's a consultant for ethics at New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation. Good morning to you, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
We're talking about probabilities, but there's got to be some balance here. What is your perspective on the guidelines?
Well, I must say, I thought they were morally courageous. The easiest thing to do is always to say, do everything always. But these guidelines were based on an examination of evidence. And quite frankly, in regard to your last bit of discussion, the experts on this panel did not, in my judgment, need to include an expert on breast cancer in order to look at population-based studies. These are very well-trained physicians and epidemiologists. So they did the morally courageous thing. They said, we're not going to be swayed by a stakeholder analysis, which is the way America basically does everything. Those people who can argue more articulately will get their position supported.
Well,
we're going to look at the evidence.
And that's where we go next. How should, in your view, individuals take this information, the public health statistics, how should they use this information to make their own personal decisions, in your view?
Well, if there is a problem with the recommendation, it's exactly in that area. Because an individualized discussion with your physician is always the way to make a choice.
Of course.
Quite frankly, if an insurance company were to disregard the results of that discussion, it should be, in our much-hoped-for national policy, enforced that they would be required to pay for it. The problem is that until now, many people have not had physicians. So I'm assuming that this task force report envisions our new era, with God's help and a little luck, we'll actually have a national health care policy where people will have physicians.
So are you concerned lacking that national health insurance plan that insurance companies might be likely to refuse to pay for mammograms for women in their 40s without a known risk factor?
If we don't get a national health insurance plan, then there are ethical problems with every part of it, and this will be yet one more. It's impossible to create just and fair and evidence-based programs in an unjust and unfair system.
Nancy Dubler, she's senior associate at Montefiore Einstein Bioethics Center. Thank you so much for joining us. When we come back, we'll open the phones, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
Grammy Award-winning violinist Joshua Bell on Collaborating with Friends. He talks about performing at major concert halls around the world, taking part in a White House music series, and playing for change at a D.C. metro. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. It's time to open the phones. First to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, Rhonda. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. First, I'd like to say that they keep saying it's not a cost analysis, and then they keep saying, but we don't have the time. Time equals money in most businesses. So that's just one point. Second, I've got three family members that have had breast cancer. Every one of them have found it either through self-examination or through mammogram, and they were in their 40s, and they're still alive and healthy. And I just find it to be such a coincidence that there's this major national discussion about how defensive health care costs too much money, and the group says that it has nothing to do with money. I had renal cell cancer. I know we're not talking about that, but that I found myself.
All right, Rhonda, thanks for calling. Dr. Petiti, how do you respond?
Well, first of all, I think when we hear stories like Rhonda's stories, it puts a human face to the dilemma that women face about being screened. I would hope that nothing that the task force said would be would be portrayed as not celebrating what has happened because of advances in screening. But again, this is not something where a postcard should come in the mail and say you should be screened. This woman is clearly in a very high-risk group.
All right. Here's an email from Marcia, who says, I applaud the task force commitment to evidence-based information rather than the emotional hearsay approach that Americans usually take to healthcare information. If I listen carefully to what the task force actually recommended, it makes perfect sense. Dr. Zerbier.
I think it makes no sense. I think there's nothing morally courageous about denying a woman an option to have a mammogram, which is effectively what this is doing. There's nothing morally courageous about saying don't examine your breasts. Having a dilemma, you talked about a dilemma for women to decide whether or not they needed a mammogram. That involves an option, and taking away the option takes away the dilemma. There'll be no choice. If we look at the evidence says mammography saves lives.
And we're joined now by Arthur Kaplan. He's professor of bioethics and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Good to have you with us, Dr. Kaplan.
Hi, Diane.
You have said that this is an attempt to build evidence-based medicine. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, we hear a lot in the health reform debate, and you've talked a little about it already, about the need to link reimbursement to evidence. So here's a situation in which people have tried in good faith to compile the evidence about what on average might be worth reimbursing in terms of a screening practice. The reaction is, look, there's still some benefit. It may be small for the average woman, even under 50, and there's certainly a subpopulation of risk folks for whom there is more benefit to having screening. And I worry that this shows that it's going to be very, very difficult to have evidence-based medicine guide healthcare reimbursement decisions. There's a lot riding on the idea that if we got the evidence, we'd be able to spend our money more effectively, more efficiently, save money. I'm not sure that's the only thing at issue. Part of it is ethics. Part of it is the individual's right to have something that has marginal benefit not taken away from them. Some of it is not being driven by the averages, but sometimes needing to understand that there are at-risk groups. So this makes me very skeptical about our ability to use evidence to guide reimbursement.
And how hard do you think it's going to be for women who've been told for years and years, you really must have this test, to now be told at certain ages, maybe not?
You know, quite frankly, I don't think it's going to be possible to take it off the table. The educational message has been strong. It has come from consumer groups, doctors, professional societies. It has been relentless to come along now and say, you know what, we're just not sure that on average the data is there to support third-party reimbursement for this. If you want to go out and pay your $100 and get it, okay, but it's not really there. I think politically is, to put a fine-tuned ethical word on it, hopeless. I mean, taking that benefit away, I don't think it's going to happen.
Now, Dr. Kaplan, recently we heard about prostate cancer. Are the issues between the regular screening for breast cancer similar to those for prostate cancer?
Very, very similar. On average, men who are older are going to show some sign of prostate cancer development. Most of the time, they will die before the prostate cancer does them in. There are subpopulations, which we have a harder time identifying right now, for whom testing is important because that cancer really does kill them much more quickly. But that isn't the average, and that isn't the norm. And so there's a lot of people who would say, I don't recommend getting prostate cancer testing. You get too many false positives, too many operations done that have nasty side effects. I think you're better off in some ways not doing that, with a subpopulation of folks who are at risk saying, well, wait a minute, I have this in my family, and it's killed a number of my relatives. Very similar situation, Diane.
So are you suggesting that those who do not have that kind of risk background in their family, that the same thing might be true, that what a mammogram might show in the early stages, a small growth in the breast, might in fact turn out to be not the thing that does them in?
Yes, exactly. Very, very similar parallel situation. If you look at the literature on both of these screening tests, they look very, very similar in terms of people worrying that too many false positives, too many false results indicating a problem that leads to unnecessary worry and sometimes unnecessary surgery. And then situations where the thing that kills you isn't this slow-growing cancer, but something else.
And I gather at this point we have no way of knowing if a cancer is spotted, if a growth is spotted. We have no way of knowing the difference between one that's going to kill you and one that's not.
Right. And the dream is that we develop specific information about people's genetic makeup, their biology, so we could say that woman with that growth is really in the risk group, even if she didn't have a family history. That man with that growth is really in a risk group, but we don't have that kind of precision genetic testing yet. I think we'll have it 5 to 10 years from now. We don't have it now. So you're kind of operating with bad news, but in the dark. You're not quite sure what to do in both cases.
So overall, are you in support of these recommendations?
I do support the recommendations. I think they're an honest attempt, and I don't think they were driven by money. I think they really looked at the data, and there's a lot of discussion of this. It's not something that just came out today. It's been kicked around for a while now that breast cancer mammography and self-examination may not deliver very much in terms of years of life saved on average. But at the same time, having said that I get the recommendations, I think the lesson is if we're going to do health reform with an eye toward evidence, we better be doing it with new procedures and going forward, going backwards and trying to take things away from people, particularly when we spent a couple of decades selling it to them. I don't think it's possible.
Dr. Zerbier, would you like to comment?
I think talking about evidence-based medicine is essential. And the evidence, which the task force admits, is that the evidence shows that breast cancer screening saves lives. And 25% of women who get breast cancer are women in their 40s. What you're doing also, you're talking about anxiety, you're taking a test away that actually is very reassuring for many women in their 40s. So I'm not sure what evidence you're talking about when the evidence says mammography, and the task force agrees, mammography screening saves lives. I think Dr. Kaplan is putting a more honest spin on this, in that it does come down to money, and we have to look at getting the most bang for our buck.
Dr. Kaplan.
Yeah, I think it is true that there are some lives saved. They're just not as many as people hoped. That's the difference. You got a smaller number being saved than people hoped you'd get by doing regular screening and self-examination. So there are some people whose lives are saved. And if you look at it from the cruel, unblinking eye of economics, then you say, well, 37 million mammography each year, roughly $100 a shot, $3.7 billion. That's not the best way to spend. Each person who wants to protect themselves should spend the $100 out of their own pocket. Society shouldn't do it. Having said that, I don't think we're going backwards here. Too well entrenched.
But then you've got the question of how many deaths are acceptable versus the cost of the mammography.
You know, the way I'd put it is this. If you have a new drug and you're trying to argue how many lives saved or deaths prevented, is it worth it to us before we say, let's spend $100,000 per drug? We face those decisions right now with certain drugs, and we're a little leery to put that money out there. But when you have something that's already been funded and it's saving fewer lives than you might have hoped, but still saving them, I think the public policy lesson is it's very hard to take the benefit away and probably unethical to take the benefit away. You can't go backwards that way. I know there are economists and policymakers who think they're going to do it. I think this furor over this recommendation shows it's not going to happen.
All right. Let's take a caller in Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Susan. You're on the air.
Yes. I think this is an assault on women, absolutely. And I think that if you brought up the prostate cancer, I think if this study had been on that and that it might save a few lives but not that many, I think there would be an uproar that we'd be hearing it. I'd hear it from here.
But now, hasn't there been something of a similar study, Dr. Kaplan?
There have been similar studies on prostate. Still, the coverage has been there, and we haven't seen the same sort of task force meeting yet. Maybe it's coming on what to do about reimbursement here. I'll concede this. I think the caller's right. There has been sexism in medicine. It has been true historically that women's lives for different diseases have not been valued in the same way. More effort at heart disease in men than heart disease in women would be an example. So there is some bias. I think it does show. Nevertheless, I think from the point of view of ethics, once you commit and say we're going to cover this, even though data starts to show up saying, I don't know, it's not as good as we hoped, it's very hard to take something away.
And
that is a real important lesson.
You are listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Portage, Michigan. Good morning, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I just want to express my outrage and wonder, the question I have is how do we, other than your show, express our outrage over what they're trying to cloak in a courageous banner? It makes no common sense. I think women understand that it makes no common sense, especially the self-examination. To take that away is utterly ridiculous.
And of course, that is a cost-benefit ratio, is it not? That is taking the time, the doctor takes the time to explain how to do a breast exam. Dr. Zerbier.
We need to throw all we can at it. It seems to me that ignoring your breasts is not good policy. And I have seen enough patients in my practice of 17 years find their own breast cancers. It's not inconsiderable that early detection, even when the patient finds it, affords a less expensive, less morbid treatment option. In other words, the recommendations from this panel will allow cancers to grow farther along, and the treatment required will more often be mastectomy if they survive their disease, instead of what we're working toward is lumpectomy and trying to avoid chemotherapy.
Dr. Petiti, what is your concern or your prediction as to what insurance companies might do with the recommendations that you have issued?
Well, the task force is not an insurance coverage body. And I want to emphasize that nothing that the task force said or recommended was meant to take away from women or from society the right to cover this the way it is. I also want to point out that this is not about coverage. We're not taking something away. I think there is far more concern and perhaps anger being created by the way that this recommendation is being portrayed than the way that the recommendation was written.
But you yourself are portraying the recommendations, and there is still, as you've heard this morning, a great deal of questioning, and you've heard the word outrage.
I have heard it, and I have been getting email telling me personally of the outrage. I've been attempting to make myself as available as possible to explain that the recommendation is not a recommendation against women in their 40s ever having mammograms. It is a recommendation about evidence and using evidence to make informed decisions about the age to start being screened. It's a recommendation that says that routine screening, that is the screening where a postcard comes in the mail, is not perhaps the best way to go about having a conversation that where the risks and the benefits are part of the equation.
All right, and we'll have to leave it at that, Dr. Diana Petitti, Dr. Rebecca Zerbier, Nancy Dubler, and Arthur Kaplan. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.